So this morning, our scripture reading is the third chapter of Habakkuk, and we complete this week our four-week study of the small prophetic book of the book of Habakkuk. And this is a prayer. Chapter 3 is a prayer prayed by this prophet Habakkuk, but it's not a prayer in isolation. It's a prayer in context. In other words, in order to appreciate chapter 3, you really have to understand the context of chapters 1 and 2. So just a very quick review as we sort of wrap up the four-part series and as we prepare to read Habakkuk 3, right? Quick review. You have this guy, Habakkuk, who goes to God, probably around 600 BC or so, and he lays out his heart before God and he asks, he says, God, how long are you going to tolerate injustice in Judah? That's where he lived, the nation state of Judah. And he's just torn up by the evil around him and the disregard among God's supposed people for God's law. And he sees it everywhere. That's Habakkuk chapter 1, verses 1 to 4. Now, God responds to Habakkuk and he says, look, don't worry. Don't worry. I've got a plan. I figured it all out. I'm going to deal with the evil that's in Judah. I'm going to bring the Babylonian Empire, and I'm going to have them destroy Judah as judgment. How's that? In order to get the people's attention. That's Habakkuk 1:5-11. And Habakkuk hears this proposal of God and says, hey, God, I don't like that idea. I don't like it at all. That's not what I meant. Because the injustice of Babylon is actually worse than the injustice of Judah. And so how could you allow them to have victory when they're even worse than we are? Right? That's Habakkuk 1:12 through Habakkuk 2:1, right? And then what we looked at last week, God responds one more time. And he says, look, Habakkuk, he said, you're going to have to sit back and you're going to have to watch and you're going to have to trust me. I'm going to deal with Babylon. I am. I'm going to deal with the injustice. I'm going to deal with their sin. I'm going to do it perfectly, and you're going to have to trust me in faith. That's essentially Habakkuk 2, verse 2 to 20. And so now what we come to in Habakkuk 3 is Habakkuk, having had some time to do some thinking, he now shows in this prayer that he has considered what God has said. And it's a pretty mature prayer. Now, prayers of lament, prayers of anguish, like in chapter 1, they're not bad prayers. They're not necessarily worse prayers than prayers of praise and faith, like we see in chapter 3. But chapter 3 is more mature. Habakkuk has grown. He's grown through his interaction with God, and then this is what comes out. This is what he says. So this is our scripture reading, Habakkuk chapter 3. Listen while I read. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet, according to Shigionoth. O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light. Rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. I saw the tents of Cushan in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Was your anger against the rivers, or your indignation against the sea, when you rode on your horses on your chariot of salvation? You stripped the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and writhed. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. The sun and moon stood still in their place, at the light of your arrow as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. You marched through the earth in fury. You threshed the nations in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. You pierced with his own arrows the heads of his warriors, who came like a whirlwind to scatter me, rejoicing as if to devour the poor in secret. You trampled the sea with your horses, the surging of mighty waters. I hear, and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. Now, this is the last, like I said, of 4 weeks that we're spending looking at this very short book of Habakkuk. And I want to end by making it very practical and somewhat personal. And so, may I ask, how are you reacting to fear these days? Fear. Have you felt it? Right? The anxiety of the moment that comes from the intense uncertainty all around us. Right? You don't know what's going to happen next. It's sort of like that feeling that some of us have had, where you go to a cancer screening maybe, and you don't know what the doctor's going to say. Or maybe the fear comes from having some certainty about what's coming next, but you're sort of afraid of what it's going to feel like when it happens. In other words, you know it's coming, like you have the cancer diagnosis, but now you're on your way to your first treatment. You know what's going to happen, but you're afraid of what it's going to feel like when it does. Now, there's a lot of life that feels like that. Now, maybe it feels like that because maybe you, a family member, a neighbor, maybe you've been diagnosed with COVID-19. Right? Maybe you're out of work. Your business has been shut down. You don't know what the future looks like. And so to you, maybe the virus isn't even as scary as the shutdown that the virus has caused. Or maybe at the moment you're actually doing okay. I mean, after all, you're home, maybe you can work from home. Your income hasn't been interrupted. You have food, you have your TV, everything. So long as the world is kind of shut down, you're relatively content with the world around you. You've got relatively little contact with the world, relatively little then exposure to the virus and the potential for getting sick. But the fear for you comes as you think about the world opening back up. That actually scares you, right? Because then you might go back to work, right? Because then more people will be out and about. Then you worry about exposure to the coronavirus then, not now, but in the future. My daughter asked me the other day, she said, why don't you and mommy get scared? It was an interesting kind of question. And by that, I discovered what she meant was, why don't you jump through the ceiling when I hide behind the wall and yell boo at you? That's what she meant. But I had to tell her that, of course, there are lots of things that make mommy and I afraid sometimes. Right? Fear is real for all of us. Now, that doesn't mean that fear needs to control us. It doesn't mean that fear needs to paralyze. It doesn't mean that fear needs to win. But the presence of fear is very understandable in a world of uncertainty and in a world of suffering. Even Habakkuk, having reached this state of resolute faith and trust in God here in chapter 3, even Habakkuk still feels it, right? You see it in verse 16, right? His body trembles, it says. His lips quiver. He feels the impending disaster that is coming for Judah. He feels it in his bones. Now, no doubt, right, this continued presence of physical fear, even in the midst of spiritual faith, there's no doubt that it may be, at least in part, for all of us, this fact that we continue to be afraid at certain times, it's no doubt in part, at least a result of our own weakness, right? It might not always be a sinless kind of a fear. It can sometimes be related to sin and doubt and unbelief. But nonetheless, it is a condition that seems to be a reality, one way or the other, even for the sincere Christian. Right? The reality that sincere spiritual faith seems to exist oftentimes right alongside real physical fear. A condition that God, in his purpose, seems to allow even some of his most faithful servants to experience, right? Maybe you remember the prophet Jeremiah. He was a contemporary of Habakkuk, who spoke news of judgment to Judah at this time, right before the conquest of Judah by Babylon, right? He suffered with depression. Right? You had John the Baptist, who was this bold, brash kind of a guy. John the Baptist, when he was thrown into prison, he questioned his calling. Even the Apostle Paul said that there were times when he was perplexed about what was going on. And there was times when he repeatedly asked God to remove some of the physical suffering that he was experiencing. Right? So if you're a Christian who struggles with fear, it's important for you to hear this, because what it means is you're not alone. Right? But even if you're not a Christian and you're watching this, it's actually also really important for you to hear this, because you need to know that Christians, even though they're Christians, still struggle with things like this. See, the real question is not whether you struggle with them. The real question is how. Right? How do you struggle? How do you face it? And what do you do when you experience it? Right? Because what you do with the fear is what distinguishes the biblical response from the typical responses to fear. Now, what are the typical responses to fear? How do most people typically react to it? Well, it's usually a combination of things, but there's a couple of main categories, right? The first response to fear are those who just hide in their closet. They just scream, cry, turn into a mess. They're just paralyzed, right? And we shouldn't make fun of people like that, because even those who don't have chronic debilitating phobias, even those who don't struggle with this as a chronic condition, have felt at times a feeling of panic that gives you at least a glimpse of what that's like, right? That's one approach, panic in the midst of fear. Now, then, on the other hand, there are the Stoics. There are those who just sort of resign themselves to suffering and to fear. They say, well, look, we all suffer. This is how I deal with fear. I tell myself, look, we all suffer. It's our lot. We all die. Suck it up. Stiff upper lip. Keep moving forward. There's no crying in baseball, right? And we do have to say that approach, of course, is probably more useful in certain crisis situations than just simply falling apart and melting into a puddle, right? It's more useful. But all by itself, it still is, we have to be honest, fairly cynical and unfeeling to be a Stoic, right? Because, of course, look, we don't want a doctor in the emergency room who just melts into a puddle when he's faced with a stressful situation. But neither, if we're honest, do we want one who's a Stoic, who just says, if he dies, he dies. What's for lunch? Right? That's the second approach, Stoicism. Now, there's a third approach. The third approach is detachment. In other words, we attempt best we can to just detach from reality. We don't panic. We don't collapse into a puddle of our own tears. We just try best we can to pretend as if there's nothing wrong. Or we use something to try to dull the pain so that we can't feel it any longer. We say life's just too depressing. It's too out of control to handle. What can I binge watch on Netflix? That's what we do. Or we go for the pint of Ben and Jerry's. Or worse, or more destructively, we retreat into hours of pornography, or into the nightly routine of the six pack, or whatever it might be. Whatever we can use to try to dull the fear and allow us to pretend that the world really isn't scary. That's the third approach, detachment. Now, a fourth approach is what some might call bravado. Bravado. Now, these are the people who say, who's afraid of a little virus? And we're gonna fight this thing. Right, we're gonna fight this thing and we're gonna win because we're smarter, because we're gonna work harder, because we have confidence in scientific ingenuity, in the human spirit, whatever. Now hear me again. Right? This is more socially constructive than detaching and just pretending as if everything's fine, right? If you had your choice, you'd rather have scientists at Johns Hopkins and the Mayo Clinic, you'd rather have them working around the clock, fighting, trying to find COVID-19 treatments, you'd rather have them working around the clock than just sitting back eating Ben and Jerry's. But at the end of the day, all the work that we do, there are still thousands, 75,000 individuals, in fact, as of the other day, where all the hard work is not going to have a positive impact on their particular situation. Right? So while all these responses to fear, they're all at some level understandable, and they have varying degrees of social usefulness, don't get me wrong, but in reality, while we move back and forth between one or the other, all of them, at the end of the day, are really unsatisfying. Which is why, after a lengthy introduction, the response of Habakkuk in the midst of his verse 16 kind of fear is so instructive for us. Why we need Habakkuk here. Because listen to this. Because when faced with the greatest catastrophe of his lifetime, the prophet Habakkuk does two very critical things. He returns to what he knows to be true, and he trusts in God's promises. In other words, he goes to facts and he goes to faith. Because we need both in the face of fear. In the face of fear, we need facts and we need faith. Right? We need facts. We need to return to what we know to be true. We need to return to what's certain, what is objectively true and historically happened. And this is important because God does not ask us to disconnect ourselves from historical reality. But second, we need facts, but second, we need faith. In other words, we need to view the current reality, which may still contain uncertainty and suffering that gives rise to fear. We need to view it through a different lens. We need to view it through the lens of God's promises. And that's what Habakkuk does here in chapter 3. That's so brilliant. That's such a perfect ending to this short little book. And it's what gives us, gives you, gives me, it's what gives us a battle plan to fight the fears that arise within us when we face uncertainty and suffering. So what do we do when we face fear? We fight with facts and faith, just like Habakkuk. And in verses 2 to 15, we see him being reminded by fact, right? He's reminded by fact. And then in verses 17 to 19, we see him rejoicing by faith, facts and faith. Now, first, verses 2 to 15, we see Habakkuk being reminded by fact. Look at verse 2. Look at verse 2 again. It says, O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. Now, what's Habakkuk saying? He's saying, I've heard all about you, Lord. Right? And I know I've said this before, but the word that he uses for Lord here is significant because it's the covenant name for God. It's Jehovah. It's the name that God gave Moses at the burning bush when Moses was afraid to go to Pharaoh. And God said, you're not going to go alone. Right? When you go to Pharaoh, he told Moses, when you go to Pharaoh, you tell him that I am sent you. You tell him Yahweh, Jehovah sent you. And Habakkuk is saying, I've heard about you, Lord. And I stand in awe of what you've done. I fear your work. That's what it means. I stand in awe of what you've done. And he wants God to keep that knowledge and that awe of his powerful work. He wants him to keep that alive. In the second part of verse 2, right? He says, in the midst of the years, revive it. Make it known. Keep it alive, Lord. Don't let us forget it. Preserve it even as you purify us and even as you correct us. Don't let us forget your historical character and your work. And then verses 3 to 15 really is then a more detailed review of God's powerful working, right? What Habakkuk does is he rehearses the facts. Now, it's a bit poetic, and I won't go through it by detail verse by verse, but as you study, it becomes clear enough what he's talking about here. It kind of reads like the Song of Moses in Exodus chapter 15. Right? It's a salvation story that Habakkuk is telling here. Right? This is the recounting of how God saved his people from slavery in Egypt. Now, for example, let's just quickly skim through it. Right? Verse 3, it says, God came from Teman, from Mount Aran. Now, both of these are mountain ranges in the south, and they suggest the path of the Israelites following the Exodus. Right? Then verse 4, it says, God's brightness, his splendor, displayed in the pillar of fire and cloud that led the people. That's what it's talking about. And then in verse 5, you see the reference to pestilence and plague, right? The plagues of God's judgment that were experienced by the Egyptians. And then verse 7 is the reference to the other nations that heard about what God did in Egypt, heard about God's power when the Israelites came out of Egypt, and they were afraid. And then in verses 8 and 9, Habakkuk rehearses God's power over nature, specifically against the rivers and the seas. And you just have to remember, right? The Nile River was turned to blood. The Red Sea was what God used to destroy the Egyptian army. And the Jordan River was split in two to allow Israel to cross. Now, verses 11 and 12, right? You have this the stilling of the sun and the moon, referring to the victory of Joshua over the Gibeonites in Joshua chapter 10 as the Israelites took the promised land. Right? God marched like a warrior on behalf of his people, not just to free them from slavery, but to also bring them into the promised land and give them rest and peace. And then finally, verses 13 to 15, right, we see again God fighting for the salvation of his people, now by destroying his enemies and destroying them completely, right? The Egyptians, the Canaanites, right? Whoever specifically it might be referring to. Now, I would encourage you to go deeper into that, and you can study that verse by verse, but what I want you to see is Habakkuk's strategy, right? When faced with fear, what Habakkuk does is he goes back to the historical facts of God's salvation and God's provision. He says, God, for whatever I don't know and for whatever I don't understand, I cannot deny the facts. You are a God who has acted in the past on behalf of your people. Now, this was going to be put to the test, right? For hundreds of years, this is basically what the people, like Habakkuk, this is basically what they had to go on. Now, it's not as if God stopped acting. He didn't take a vacation. But in terms of high-profile, paradigm-shifting acts of salvation that revealed his character and displayed his power to rescue, right? When it comes to that kind of category of acting, right? There was no other period in history that captured that more clearly and in a more concentrated way than the rescue of God's people from Egypt and their deliverance into the promised land. And that's what they had to go on. Now, then, after hundreds of years of people having to look back to that, then along comes a guy named Jesus. And he affirmed all the same facts as Habakkuk, but he started to add to them even greater promises than Habakkuk knew. And he would say things to his followers. He would say things like, in this world you will have tribulation, but take heart because I have overcome the world. Right? And he wasn't just talking when he said things like that, right? Because Jesus, he backs up all his talk, all his promises. He backs it up with some new facts. In Mark chapter 9, we read that Jesus is talking to his disciples, and he says, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they will kill him. And when he is killed, after 3 days, he will rise. He says, the Son of Man is going to be delivered into the hands of men, and they're going to kill him, and after 3 days, he's going to rise. And that's exactly what ends up happening. Right? Jesus backs up his promises with some facts of his own. He dies at the hands of the Jewish religious leaders, at the hands of the Roman civil authorities, and then, after 3 days, he rises again. Habakkuk starts his prayer. Go back to verse 2. Remember, he starts his prayer at the end of verse 2. By making this request, he asks God to remember mercy in the midst of justice. In wrath, remember mercy. And normally, you don't think of those two things going together, right? God is just and God is merciful is both true, but it's hard for us to picture both of them being true at the same time. Well, see here, in Jesus's facts, in the facts that Jesus gives us, in the death and the resurrection of Jesus, you have the greatest demonstration of the seriousness of God about justice, right? We see the greatest demonstration of the wrath that he rightly displays against sin. And you have, at the very same time, the greatest display of mercy as that wrath is poured out. Poured out not because it's not poured out on the deserving, but it's poured out on Jesus, right? You have the ultimate act of God remembering mercy and wrath on the cross. And it, for us then, that cross becomes then the ultimate fact of history. And the resurrection that follows, the ultimate fact of history. A fact that we need to hear over and over again and again. In the midst of the years, revive it, as Habakkuk would say. In the midst of the years, make it known, as Habakkuk would say. And this becomes then the tool by which we fight fear now. Right? We go back to the fact that God has acted on our behalf with finality to free us and to deliver us to safety. And this is what separates Christianity from the other responses to fear. It's not that Christians don't feel fear. It's that Christians have a God of historical action. James Montgomery Boyce, the great pastor of 10th Presbyterian Church in Philadelphia, he said that biblical religion, listen to this, he said that biblical religion is not a religion of ideas, essentially, though it contains many great ideas. He says it is essentially a religion of acts, God's mighty acts. Do you hear that? Biblical religion is not essentially a religion of ideas, it's a religion of acts. One of the guys in our congregation told me the story of the time when one of his daughters was driving back from this area to college in western Pennsylvania after break one year. And he took his daughter to meet some others from the school, and they were gonna meet and they were gonna carpool. They met at a church a couple hours closer to the college than here. One of his daughter's friends her dad was a pastor, and the girls were gonna drive together the rest of the way. Well, the college students were driving across central Pennsylvania, and the weather conditions were just horrible. It was a blizzard, terrible storm, and cars were just sliding off the road left and right, and the girls ended up in a ditch. Now, everyone was okay, but they were stranded. Their car was in a ditch. And so when his daughter called him, the first thing that dad did was call the father of his daughter's friend, the one who was the pastor, the one who lived 2 hours closer to the car in the ditch. And the pastor said, well, the local police, the authorities, they're going to be able to respond faster than me. So he said, I'm going to pray for the girls in the ditch. To which the dad said, well, that's fine, I'll pray too. But while I'm praying, I think I'm going to get in my truck and I'm going to drive through the snow and I'm going to get my daughter in the ditch. Now, that's not a knock on the pastor dad, right? He might not have had a truck. He might not have been able to make the drive without himself ending up in a ditch. The point is not to make a comparison about which dad was the better dad. The point is that when God looks upon our fear and when God looks upon our suffering, he doesn't just sympathize. He doesn't just watch from afar and wait for news about what's going to happen next. No, when God hears about our situation, when he sees our suffering, he comes to us. He experiences the storm for himself and he rescues his kids. He acts. He comes to us in the ditch. Now, if you're searching for what to do with your fears, this, I have to say, this is the first thing that you need to settle. You need to settle this question: is Jesus fact or fiction? Did God really send his one and only son to be born into a small Jewish town 2,000 years ago, to live a perfect life, to die on a Roman cross, as he predicted, rise again from the dead? Did he do that? Did God really come to pull us out of the ditch? You have to settle that fact, right? There's a reason why Paul makes the historical resurrection of Jesus the linchpin of his argument for Christianity. Right? There's a reason why in 1 Corinthians 15, Paul basically says, look, if Jesus hasn't been raised from the dead, we're all liars, right? Jesus was a liar. I'm a liar for claiming that he's the way to God, right? If he didn't really rise from the dead, there's no life after this. So let's just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we all die. That's what he says in 1 Corinthians 15, right? He's saying, don't give me this nonsense that the resurrection is just some metaphor of hope and rebirth, like spring flowers and little chicks at Easter. He says, I'm not going to face the suffering that I face for that. In the middle of the Cold War, there was a young man named Joseph Ton in communist Romania, who became a Christian in a country where being a Christian was a very dangerous thing to be. But Ton grew in his faith while he was in college, and he wanted to become a pastor. And one of his friends, who was trying to encourage him, gave him a book. He found a book on Christian theology. Now, it happened to be a book, though, that was written by a very liberal Christian theologian who himself actually didn't believe any of the things that were really true about Christianity. He didn't believe in the necessity of Jesus dying on the cross. He didn't believe in a literal resurrection. He claimed that the Bible's teaching on these points, that it was all metaphorical, that these acts of Jesus were metaphors. And so what Joseph Ton did was, he goes to his professor, he's shaken by this, and he asks his professor about the book, and his professor says, well, he says, the man's a very well-known theologian, he's very, very smart, and so what he says must be so. And it caused Ton to walk away from the ministry for years because he reasoned, if the acts of God were metaphors, if they weren't facts, then it wasn't worth it in a dangerous place like Romania for him to be a Christian. He says, I went to my room and I said, it's risky to preach the gospel here. He says, I was ready to risk my life for the truth, but for metaphors, I'll risk nothing. And years, for years, he just walked away. Now, ultimately, Tan realized that he was wrong to walk away from God and from his calling as a pastor, but his reasoning at the time was still solid. For metaphors, I will risk nothing, he said. I mean, metaphors, ideas, they can be helpful when times are good, right? They can help us when help us along when life is quiet, when our problems seem manageable, when we don't need to wear masks to protect one another from disease, when the summer tourists are bringing their money to the Jersey Shore, when fear is relatively low. Metaphors can be useful then. They can be helpful little Facebook posts, but they won't ultimately help us when fear spills into everyday life. At that point, Christianity is fact or it is nothing. And it is fact. We have a God who acts. That's point number one. What does Habakkuk do to fight fear? Right? We see him reminded by fact. Now, the fact of God's character and the fact of God's work. Now, point number two, we see him rejoicing by faith. And this is in verses 17 to 19. And it bears rereading slowly as we close. This is what Habakkuk writes in the last three verses. He says, though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, and the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. Now, these are some of the most beautiful lines of poetry in the Bible, because they don't gloss over the pain. They don't back down from the pain. They don't underestimate the fear, but they do trust in the one who defeats the fear. Now, let's go verse by verse and sort of see how it works. Now, verse 17 is a statement of realism, right? No blossom, no fruit, no harvest, no flocks, no herd. It's a pretty bleak picture of economic collapse, right? You thought the unemployment numbers were bad on Friday, right? This is about as bleak as you can get. And it doesn't matter where it comes from, right? We feel the bleakness. It doesn't matter where it comes from, right? It could be a virus that forces global economic production to a standstill, or it could be locusts devastating crops in East Africa, or it could be murder hornets threatening to disrupt the pollination of fruit trees on the West Coast. In any case, whether Habakkuk's time or our time, right? This was Habakkuk envisioning rightly the devastation that's going to come when Babylonians invade. And we can have the same kinds of realistic views of our own current situation. It's bad. It may get worse. So Habakkuk isn't glossing over anything, right? You can't accuse him of just being a don't worry, be happy kind of a guy yet. Yet if verse 17 is a statement of realism, then verse 18 is a statement of defiance, right? He says, whatever may happen, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. You see what he does, right? He resolves himself to rejoice. Now, rejoice in the poverty? No, right? Rejoice in the suffering? No. Rejoice in the economic collapse that's coming? Definitely not. No, none of those things. He's not going to rejoice in those things. He's going to rejoice in the Lord, in the God of my salvation. On the basis of the facts, he chooses to trust. Right? In other words, he's going to defy the uncertainty and the fear. He's going to defy it with faith. Not an ungrounded faith. He's not wishing. He's going to defy it with a faith in a God whose promises about the future can be trusted, because this is a God who he has already demonstrated to have acted in the past. Right? That's verse 17 and verse 18. Now, the realism of verse 17 that leads to the defiance of verse 18 concludes with the confidence of verse 19. He says, God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. Now, the translators use the word deer here, and that might be a little misleading, because it literally says, the Lord sets my feet like hinds' feet. It doesn't actually refer to a deer, at least not as we envision Bambi, right? Because we drive around here, this area around here, and you know, in the evening, and we see deer in the fields, we see them frolicking in the meadow, and it all seems very flat, right? In a deer in a field. But Old Testament scholar John Currid is an archaeologist, and he's traveled to Israel many times, and he talks about visiting the nature reserve at the site of En Gedi, next to the Dead Sea in Israel. And he says there in the nature reserve, he says, it's absolutely stunning to watch the ibex, right, which is an impressive, strong mountain goat. He said it's absolutely stunning to watch the ibex climbing these steep rock cliffs that border the nature reserve, to watch them keep their footing on these little tiny outgrowths and watch them scale the walls. Currid says that's the image that Habakkuk wants us to have in mind here. Right? This is the confidence that Habakkuk has, the confidence that can be ours through the same kind of faith. The confidence that even in the high and the dangerous places, God will keep our feet secure as we climb. Now, I don't know if you've ever heard of William Cowper. William Cowper was an incredibly talented, but he was a deeply troubled poet and hymn writer in the 1700s in England. He was heavily influenced by the strong theology of George Whitefield, and he was even more heavily influenced by the excellent pastoral care of John Newton, and both of those names you might have heard of. But despite knowing men like that, and despite having the theological training and underpinning that he had, and despite having all kinds of material privilege and benefit from his father and from others who tried to care for him, he nonetheless, William Cowper, nonetheless struggled with tremendous bouts of fear and paralyzing depression, right? Even after he became a Christian, even after he had all the categories to understand his struggle, he was never really delivered from it while he lived. And yet, Cowper's words live on, and they speak of the fight that he had, even in the midst of his pain, even in his own inability and his own strength to be able to defeat the thing that caused him so much pain. We see his fight, the fight that had been won for him, and the fight that is won for us by Jesus, the fight with fear that we wage on the basis of facts and on the basis of faith. And this is what empowered Cowper to write such beautiful poetry. In one of his poems, this is what he writes. Sometimes a light surprises the Christian while he sings. It is the Lord who rises with healing in his wings. When comforts are declining, he grants the soul again a season of clear shining to cheer it after rain. In holy contemplation, we sweetly then pursue the theme of God's salvation and find it ever new. Set free from present sorrow, we cheerfully can say, let the unknown tomorrow bring with it what it may. It can bring with it nothing, but he will bear us through. Who gives the lilies clothing will clothe his people too. Beneath the spreading heavens, no creature but is fed, and he who feeds the ravens will give his children bread. Though vine nor fig tree neither, their wanted fruit should bear. Though all the field should wither, nor flocks nor herds be there. Yet God the same abideth, his praise shall tune my voice. For while in him confiding, I cannot but rejoice. Let's pray. Our Father, in the midst of pain, in the midst of struggle, and in the midst of fear, drive us to the facts of who you are and what you have done, and give us the fight of faith to be able to live in power. Oh, Lord, hold our feet closely to the rock and do not allow them to slip. Lord, help us to fight valiantly, to serve others, and to love well. I pray, Lord, that everyone listening today would understand the greatness of who you are and what you have done, and put their faith in you for the first time or again today. May they find the comfort that comes only from a relationship with you through Jesus Christ, in whose name we pray. Amen.